We're good to go?
Yes.
Good morning. We are going to call the October 19th, 2022 meeting of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District to order. I will ask Director Corona, would you like to lead us in the pledge this morning?
Please stand. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I would like to ask the Board Secretary if she would inform the public on virtual meeting participation and then call the roll of the directors.
Yes. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you have joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press star 9 to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it is your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. If you have joined the meeting by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are speaking. Now roll call. President Pauly?
Here.
Director Record?
Here.
Director Corona?
Here.
Director Armstrong?
Here.
And our legal counsel is present.
Very good. I understand we have a couple of people that would like to do public comment. I understand Mr. Dominigoni would like to do public comment, but that will be on item number 4. So we will wait for that on our agenda. But we have a Mr. Dan Felkins, is it, sir? Please. Welcome. Please approach the podium, and we give our public comment speakers approximately 3 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for being with us this morning.
Certainly. My name is Dan Felkins, and I am here to thank you all for participating in a coordinated meeting with the City of Murrieta senior staff, EMWD managers, property owners, and developers in what has been called the Keyhole area in Northeast Murrieta. I am one of the property owners. We are located in District 2 in the city, bounded by Whitewood Road, Clinton Keith Road, Menifee Road, and Baxter Road. There are about 55 of us property owners who collectively own 60-plus parcels totaling over 320 acres. About a dozen of us were lined up to come here this morning with an entirely different message, and then we learned about the coordinated meeting at the Alderwood Conference Center, and so we want to thank you for that. We're pretty active, and we also want to thank you for choosing that location. It's very convenient for us when we get off from work and so on. We just go right down there, so we appreciate that. Our area has been historically underrepresented when it comes to sewer and water infrastructure development. We began bringing up sewer and water infrastructure concerns with the city in 2005 and at numerous community meetings during various iterations of the general plan update, including the latest one in 2020, just 2 years ago. My neighbors and I have had many conversations with our elected officials over the years expressing concerns about our wells drying up and increased silting in our storage tanks and having to replace our pumps as they suck up the dirt and the sand from lowering aquifer levels. Some of us are having to truck in water because it's cheaper to do that than repeatedly fixing the pumps. We count on EMWD and the city both to represent and solve issues related to our basic right to access drinking water. And they are complex, we understand that. In the last 18 years, we've missed out on 3 business cycles and many opportunities for developer-led solutions to design and build both interim and permanent water and sewer solutions. You're more aware than I am that privately operated pump stations are proven and vitally important as they dramatically decrease the time it takes to bring infrastructure development to the area. They encourage developers to construct projects that result in regional solutions, and they bring more affordable housing to market in shorter times. Recently, the city and EMWD worked together to bring a water infrastructure to the Los Alamos Hills area, where just south of where our properties are located. However, we don't have access to that water. It's just too far south. One need only look to Los Alamos Hills, the Loma Linda and Kaiser Medical Centers, the Vineyard and Costco Center, and the new construction coming to the Orchard Center to recognize that with cooperation, the incentives and innovation can get a lot done, a lot accomplished. I've read your brief about the Los Alamos Hills to the property owners and your 2019 version of the sewer management plan with most of the attachments. Both items tell me that you have the charter, the expertise.
Sir, if we could, we're getting a little over on time. If you wanted to wrap it up, please.
I apologize. Thank you very much. Well, then just with that, fellow property owners and I do wish to thank you for coordinating that meeting. We look forward to it. Both developers and property owners will be there. And thank you for keeping me on track here a little bit. So,
thank you for your comments this morning, sir. Appreciate it very much. Our next individual wishing to address the board is Mr. Bruce Bornikoff. Thank you, sir. Please come forward. And we also have about a three-minute time restriction here. So the floor is yours.
Hi. Thank you very much to let me speak today. I noticed, how much water we don't have and looking to suggest something to conserve water. All of us do take showers in the morning, and how many of us do wait for the shower to get warm? So there's a lot of that water that's going down the drain. And I've installed some systems. It's called circulation pumps that hook up to the hot water that keeps the hot water circulating in your piping without wasting it. Get it closer to your faucets, your shower, and everything, and you're not waiting to let the water go down the drain. We spend a lot of money to make the water clean. We need to spend some more money to keep the water usable water. So I'm just trying to recommend. I've talked to, we've done great things with the outside of the water. Now we outside the house. Now let's see if we can get inside the house and do some more technology to save this water that we're not being able to replace because of the climate change. And I think this might be one thing that could be helpful if you guys introduce it to the customers that you serve. So basically, I just wanted to talk about that circulation system and help save some water. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Always appreciate our customers coming and making suggestions on water conservation. It's something we work very hard with at the district here. So thank you for your comments this morning. With that, we are going to go to the next item on our agenda, item 2, which is our executive reports. We'll start with our general manager, Mr. Mawad.
Good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. My report is included in your packet. It's been a very busy couple of weeks since the last board meeting, and wanted to highlight some of the key items that have transpired over the last couple of weeks. As the board is aware, last week, the Metropolitan Water District elected a new chairperson that will take the helm as of January 1st. Mr. Adan Ortega was elected with 81% support from the Metropolitan Board. His election followed a measure, or at least a motion by Chairwoman Gray to amend the admin code to provide a waiver for a third term, but unfortunately that did not receive majority support. Mr. Ortega will be the 20th chairman of the Metropolitan Board, and he will be the first Latino chairperson of the board. As you may be aware, he is a former Metropolitan employee, and he is currently a lobbyist and a communications consultant who focuses on water issues. Mr. Ortega is a resident of Fullerton and is appointed to the Metropolitan Board by the City of San Fernando. Also last week, the California Coastal Commission unanimously approved the proposed Doheny Ocean Desalinization Project, We're very pleased with that outcome, and as I reported last time, we have written a letter of support. We also had our Senior Director of Engineering, Sean Stone, that attended the Coastal Commission hearing and delivered remarks on behalf of EMWD in support of the project, which provides benefits on multiple levels, including a regional water supply benefit. Beyond that, we've also indicated our interest to the Coastal Commission in potentially participating with the South Coast Water District. And this afternoon, Linnea and I do have a meeting with the South Coast Water District and MODOC to explore development of the letter of interest, which we would like to bring back to this board for consideration. Upon execution of that letter of interest, we would recommend formation of an ad hoc committee to follow up on the potential participation effort. Also, last week, as just mentioned by our public comment, we did hold the Los Alamos town hall meeting and appreciate President Pauly and Director Corona being in attendance along with the EMWD staff as well as the city of Marietta. It was a good meeting and discussion. We had about 34 members of the community participate, representing 26 property owners. Of the 26 properties represented at the meeting, we had 25 at the conclusion of the meeting sign up in terms of indicating their interest to participate in our proposed annexation of the area as well as the water system. So really positive result from the meeting. We are currently in the process of reaching out to the balance of the property owners that were not in attendance, and potentially, depending upon the outcome of that outreach, we may have another community meeting. But we'll work closely with our public government affairs. But we are at 50% threshold in terms of getting support from the 50 property owners, and we're going to be working towards at least a 75%, if not greater, support to annex into EMWD. Also, last week, we did have a meeting with the Kaweah tribe to discuss their approach and their status of potentially securing water supply for their reservation. As you know, they have long been planning the construction of a 20-plus mile pipeline with a series of booster stations and storage reservoir on the reservation property. In the meeting, we had their legal counsel, as well as Stephen O'Neill was on that call, and President Pauly, as well as the Metropolitan Water District legal counsel. The tribe's legal counsel provided an update on where they're at with their settlement agreement, as well as their advancement of negotiations with Caltrans for right-of-way and other matters. There's still a number of key decisions that have to occur for this program to move forward, including who will be the lead on the environmental clearances, environmental report, who will construct, own, and operate the water transmission system to the tribe's property, and other decisions as well. So more conversations to come. We're going to continue to be engaged on that front with Metropolitan and the tribe to identify a solution going forward. Under items of interest to the board, this past Saturday, we held a very successful open house. We highlighted our purified water replenishment program. Again, appreciate several members of the board attending that event. We had several hundred visitors, despite the fact that we had a little bit of rain in the morning, a little bit of drizzle. I was very, very pleased to see a constant stream of community residents come in to visit our kiosks that we set up out here in the demonstration garden. I'm also really proud of our staff that were representing the district at each one of the stations. They were able to very clearly articulate what we do when it comes to recycled water, our groundwater banking program, as well as our proposed indirect potable reuse program, our purified water replenishment. Really successful event, and I felt it continues to strengthen our brand in the community and continues to advocate for our interest, and building that trust with the community is so pivotal when it comes to an IPR program. And finally, I wanted to mention that at the invitation of Congressman Calvert, I've been invited to participate in a meeting with Congressman Westerman, who is the ranking member of the House Natural Resources Committee. He will be out here visiting, and he wanted to get insight into the Colorado River issues and specifically how agencies like us and others in Riverside are dealing with the constraints on the Colorado River. So very fortunate to partake in that, and I will report back at the next board meeting on how that conversation goes. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Any questions for the general manager? Director Armstrong.
So you mentioned at Metropolitan there was a vote on changing the bylaws to allow a third term before the vote on the next chairman. What was the outcome of that vote?
There was, and my recollection, Dr. Armstrong, is that motion carried a 47% support. Dr. Record,
That's about right. Actually, it was just a waiver of the admin code, so it wasn't changing the admin code. But it did fail.
That was close.
Yeah, it was close.
Okay. And then one other question, too. On the meeting with the tribe, would there be interest of us of seeing that pipeline, if it does happen, upsized to potentially provide water? That would go up to Highway 79 South, I guess. You know, I don't know if we have service areas out there that would benefit from.
Sure. No, that's a great question. So a couple of things on that. One is at the meeting that occurred last week, the Ramona tribe was also in attendance, and they're interested in potentially receiving water from this future facility that Kaweah is contemplating. I should clarify that the water supply source is raw water, untreated water, which will be used to replenish their groundwater basin, part of the settlement agreement, and they're looking at somewhere around 5,000 acre feet per year. We will look at whether there's needs for the regional community beyond Kaweah and Ramona tribes and see if that's something we'll be interested in. That is yet to be determined.
Any other questions for the general manager? I just want to make one note on our open house. I was there. It's a very successful event. I know Director Denstedt from Western came over, and she told me she was very impressed with our operation, and I think she's doing a little spying on their behalf because she probably wants to do the same thing over there. So congratulations, everyone involved on that event.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Laura, do you have anything for us this morning?
Nothing this morning.
Very good. Nick?
Yes, thank you, President Pauley. I'd like to provide another update on our efforts to look at the feasibility of consolidating the city of Perry's water and sewer system into Eastern. As you know, this has been ongoing effort for many, many months. A lot of time and effort has gone into looking at a lot of different assessments and evaluations to see where we're at. And Thursday of last week, there was an ad hoc committee meeting, which the agenda encompassed the conclusion of all these efforts and having a serious look at the financial aspects associated with doing this. Just as a reminder, the ad hoc committee group includes two of our representatives, Director Armstrong as well as Director Slauson, and from the city, it's Mayor Michael Vargas and Councilwoman Roger Rita. And so again, you know, we really just highlighted the work that's been done. We looked at groundwater evaluation. That's complete. We put a lot of effort into examining the water and sewer systems, the condition, the operational considerations associated with that. We've estimated what we believe to be the critical capital improvements that would be necessary if we were to assume those systems. We've looked at real property, easement issues associated with infrastructure that may not be in the right of way and not necessarily have the proper easements associated with that, and then legal provisions. And specifically, we've looked at LAFCO requirements associated with the consolidation. There would not be a LAFCO requirement with that. We looked at the need for a public vote. There is not a need for the public vote. That transfer can take place without one, simply with the approvals of this board and city council. But during our legal assessment, we did come across a settlement agreement that's been entered into by a couple of homeowners associations within the North Paris water system area as well as the city, and that settlement agreement would be transferable to Eastern as a successive. We took that on, and there are some implications associated with what we can and can't do with rate increases associated with the consolidation, and our legal as well as finances is looking at all of that. At the conclusion of this discussion, there's really three key issues that we need to address. Our estimate of the capital improvements that would be necessary to address what we understand and believe are to be significant deficiencies and improvements that need to be addressed, about $15 million worth of that. That is offset with the groundwater rights of about $7.7 million. So there's roughly a gap of about $8 million that needs to be closed as a part of this financial analysis. Additionally, our financial team has identified the need for the city to move forward with rate increases. So that would entail a rate study and analysis to look at what that would take to address those capital costs, build reserves that would be necessary to support those systems. And then also, last but not least, but the first two would need to be done before we got to this, would be the HOA settlement agreement. There's potentially some strategies on how that may be addressed through negotiations with the HOA as a part of benefits that they would receive in potential consolidation with Eastern. So as far as next steps going forward, as I said, this ad hoc committee kind of looked at all this. We shared this with our representatives. One of the key next steps is looking how we can close that funding gap of roughly about $8 million. And Joe Muad has been meeting and discussing directly with county representatives as far as a potential for another tranche of ARPA funding that may be available and can be secured to address this. So there's ongoing discussions there. But the bulk of the ad hoc committee meeting was really presented by John Adams and looking at the financial model and the plan. So again, I just wanted to share this with you. Everything that we set out to do has been done. The financial model has been created. We know financially what needs to be done to potentially make this happen, but there is a funding gap that needs to be addressed and closed, and there'll be future conversations with the city as we see what options are available. Joe, is there anything you would like to add?
No, I think you covered it well.
Thank you. Comment? I just want to compliment our staff. They've done a tremendous job of analyzing this, putting in a lot of effort and work to come up with this. There is a potential solution here, but that gap is real, and the city either needs to step up and recognize that gap and help solve it, or our ratepayers, would be forced to subsidize that, which I don't think is, an alternative. But you guys have done a great job, and I feel absent, more effort on Eastern's part to find a way to solve this. It's really in the city's court to make a decision. You've done a great job.
Thank you.
Very good. Lanai, anything for us this morning?
Yes, one item, President Pauly. Yesterday, elected officials and staff from EMWD, Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District, and Western Municipal Water District, and Rancho California Water District participated in the Joint Agency Water Supply Resiliency Study Workshop Number 2. Over the past 2 months, staff and the consultant team evaluated 13 regional water supply concepts that were identified earlier this year based on the supply potential, cost, water supply independence, and other criteria, including energy efficiency and public and regulatory acceptance. Ultimately, the group agreed to further refine three of those 13 concepts, including a new ocean desalination facility, stormwater capture and recharge, and local groundwater storage of wet year imported water. The results of the study and next steps will be presented to the full board at a future meeting.
Very good. Thank you so much. I participated in that, and it was really a good meeting yesterday. So I know you had a lot to do with that, and really appreciate what you've done on that front. Matt, anything this morning?
Yeah, good morning. We're going to bring a informational item to you soon, but just want to let you know that so far, or as of the end of last week, we'd converted 22 construction sites to recycled water, totaling about 25 acre feet a month so far. And I believe we've converted a few more since then, so we're making good progress on that, and we'll bring you some details on that later. The other thing is we've been working for some time now on improving our sewer inspection programs. So we did receive the vehicle and the camera inspection equipment. We've trained up the collection staff on how to run the system and make the ratings on the sewers, and we've officially started that program. So for the last 3 to 4 weeks, we've had a crew out there doing video inspections and collecting data. So that's a good step forward. Wanted to share with you, and that's all I had.
Very good. On the recycled water on the construction sites, really appreciate that you've acted very quickly on that. I do hope we can get some of those banners out there so the public can see that we're.
Yeah, we've got a number of them out there, and I'll show you some of the pictures when we get the information item.
Perfect.
Back for you. So
appreciate that. So, all right. That will take us to item number 3 on the agenda today, which is our consent calendar. Are there any members of the board that wish to pull an item for further discussion or have a conflict? Seeing none, I will look for a motion and a second on the consent calendar. Moved by Director Record. We'd like to second Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Slauson absent. We will now go on to item 4 on our agenda, which is our action calendar. We will go to item A, which is to approve and authorize facility oversizing reimbursement with Brookfield Residential Properties for construction of the Winchester Sewer Pipeline and appropriation of the amount of $3.6 million. Corey Wallace, good morning, sir.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. I'm happy to be presenting this request today of the board to consider another partnering opportunity with Brookfield Residential Properties. They are the developer of the Cantorwood development in Menifee. I'd also like to introduce a few folks here today. We have Dave Seach with Brookfield Residential, Robert Scans with D.R. Horton, who's the home builder, and Andy Dominigoni representing the Winchester MAC as well as his land holdings. In today's presentation, I will address the following topics. I'd like to provide some references to EMWD's past planning efforts, including the recent refinements to those plans, known development projects in the area known as the Holland Channel, a graphic of the wastewater facilities proposed now and in the future, and a summary of the benefits to EMWD, the developers, and community stakeholders. Finally, I will identify the next steps along with today's recommendation. EMWD staff has been actively planning and defining sewer infrastructure needs in the Winchester-Menifee interface area for some time. Some of the most relevant work includes the wastewater facilities master planning updates that were done in 2015, and then recent completion of the Winchester MAC sewer facility study was completed in early 2022, and then staff recently prepared an implementation-based refinement of these plans to confirm facility sizing, pipeline alignments, and profile grades pertinent to significant drainage facilities in this area. Staff also identified potential locations of two future regional lift stations. I'd like to also acknowledge staff person Warren Back. He's worked very closely with our planning staff as well as the developers in this area to make this request a reality. In addition, staff has been closely coordinating with the development interests in the Holland Channel area, the Dominigoni land holdings as part of the specific plan 310 project, and Fredericks Ridge along Scott Road near Leon. As one of the larger land holdings and chairperson of the MAC, we met with Andy Dominigoni to review this plan and Andy's here today to talk about that. I believe he filled out a speaker card. But he did provide his support of this request during the meeting with staff. This map shows the proposed 27-inch gravity sewer pipeline, which is shown in gold. And this facility, in its oversized proposed oversizing, will provide significant sewering capacity for this area, equivalent to about 11,000 EDUs. The proposed oversizing contribution by EMWD of $3.69 million is based on the developer's competitive bid solicitations. The development projects that are identified here in red and are anticipated near-term projects in this Holland Channel area, and the projects outlined in blue are longer-term projects. This table summarizes those known and anticipated development projects as well as their estimated cumulative EDUs. The project, the Canterwood project in highlighted in yellow, is the sponsoring developer for this 27-inch gravity sewer facility.
You okay?
I'd like to take this time to update a reference that I learned today in the board letter in the environmental impact section. The jurisdictional land use agency is the County of Riverside, not the City of Menifee. So I'll make sure that that gets corrected in the record. This request is in accordance with the district's current policies and practices for oversizing. It does provide material benefits to EMWD, area developers, as well as future community residents. First, it eliminates any sunk costs that the development community would be potentially funding for facilities, temporary facilities such as temporary lift stations. It also reduces EMWD's implementation costs for master plan facilities because EMWD, instead of paying for the full amount, would pay the incremental cost difference between the developer's base size and the oversized facility. In addition, it has facilities that get constructed in conjunction with development. Provides the least potential for community disruption because those facilities are constructed with the roadways as the developer builds those. This slide here shows the next step. So today, the board approves this request. We would subsequently execute a facilities and services agreement with the developer for oversizing, or to include the oversizing reimbursement, and we would anticipate that to occur by the end of this month. This also shows the developer's schedule for implementation, just to provide some anticipated cash flow planning for the district. So with that, I'd like to identify the recommendation for the approval and authorization for the execution by the general manager or his designee of a standard facilities and services agreement with Brookfield Residential Properties to include sewer facility oversizing reimbursement in the amount of $3,694,246 and appropriation of that same amount from the Wastewater System Expansion Reserve Fund. With that, I'd like to answer any questions.
Any questions on this? All right, I do note we have one public speaker request on this. So, Mr. Dominigoni, if you'd like to come up. Mr. Dominigoni is chairman of the Winchester MAC. Thank you for being here today, sir.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'll start off by thanking the board, Joe, and Corey and his staff for all the information they've been sending to the MAC and personally to us at the specific plan 310. As you know, I'm going to speak in support of this project. Not only has it taken some time to get these master facilities done, I think this is one of the faster ones I've seen through Eastern that we've had. Director Pauly, the general manager, we've been going through this for how many years? Bumping rides, talking about this. Things don't happen overnight, as you well know. Some of these plans have been in the works for 15 years. Canterwood's been in there a long time. I am very pleased to see the upsize of these lines put in now for the future. SB 310 is being kicked off as we speak in some of the areas more to the south and to the east, but we'll gradually get there as time permits and as the markets hopefully stay strong. But I think we need to see more of this kind of action out of this board and from staff to help economically help this region and Eastern's region with these backbone facilities like this with developers that make it a lot easier to have these projects get online at a timelier line. And I highly recommend that you guys approve this project. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Domenigoni. With that, if there's no further questions on this, I'm going to make the motion to for this item. Do we have a second by Director Corona? May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 5-0. Again, thanks staff and the general manager and the participation of the Winchester MAC on that item. So, very good. With that, we'll go to item B, which is to approve and authorize acquisition of assessor parcel number APN 481-101-016 for an appropriation amount of $338,000 in the city of Moreno Valley. Chris Teague, I guess you're going to present this morning for us.
Yes, good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. I'm Chris Teague, real property manager for the district. We have a very unique opportunity, and staff are recommending that the board approve and authorize acquisition of the subject parcel to benefit and support the Indian Street sewer replacement project. So as shown in the image on the upper right-hand side of the screen, the subject property is located in the northwest region of Moreno Valley, south of State Route 60, and west of Indian Street. Engineering staff have advanced the Indian Street sewer relocation project, whereby an existing 8-inch gravity sewer line would be replaced with a new 15-inch line. Three non-district-owned properties will be impacted by the project. Therefore, staff began exploring easements and other property rights to move the project forward. Staff are recommending purchasing the property shown on the bottom right. It's a puzzle piece looking kind of shape at the end of Postal Avenue, directly west of Indian Street. And this property is most impacted by the project. EMWD has an existing sewer easement shown in yellow for the gravity sewer that runs east and west and bifurcates the property. In total, the property consists of 1.8 acres, with 1 acre being usable because of a drainage channel on the east side of the property. Carollo, the district's consultant project engineer, identified multiple alignments for the proposed 15-inch diameter sewer line, and the preferred alignment is shown in light green on the image on the screen. Just to give you a quick orientation, so the image is rotated about 90 degrees to the right. So the 60 freeway, which runs east and west, is shown vertically, and Indian Street, which runs north and south, is shown horizontally. Within the proposed alignment, sewer flows north to south or right to left, beginning north of the 60, traveling underneath the freeway and across the Postal Avenue property, and then through one additional property, ultimately onto the Indian Street right-of-way. EMWD expects a trenchless construction method to be used to install the 15-inch sewer line, and an adequate area is needed to carry out this method within the Postal Avenue property. So after initial due diligence and discussion with the engineering branch staff, it was determined that acquiring the parcel would be advantageous to Eastern for two primary reasons. First, for project security and risk mitigation, and second, for the anticipated financial benefits. So a little bit more on project security and risk mitigation. The Indian Street sewer relocation project has an anticipated duration of 15 months, beginning in February 2024 and completing in April 2025. The project start date is roughly 16 months away, and this property is actively listed on the open market, so we may not be dealing with the same property owner as that project start date becomes closer. If the district were to move forward with temporary or permanent easements with this existing owner, the additional encumbrances could impact the marketability of his property. So acquiring the property now in fee eliminates significant project construction risk for the district. The financial benefits, so typically Eastern staff acquire a temporary construction easement on the private property on behalf of the contractor. If the property is purchased, we will not have to acquire this easement, saving the district roughly $15,000. Additionally, contractors incur expenses of roughly $2,000 a month to lease property near active construction sites as material laydown and equipment storage sites. Field engineering will advertise this Postal Avenue property available for contractor use during construction, and allowing that selected contractor to utilize the property over the 15-month period is expected to save Eastern $30,000. Lastly, Corolla estimated the permanent easement acquisition would cost EMWD about $93,000. Combining all of those temporary and permanent easement and property acquisition costs is $138,000. So distilling all of this information down, basically district has the opportunity to apply that $138,000 in cost savings towards this $338,500 purchase price. And again, it benefits us in securing the land to advance the project. And at the end, we'll have a saleable asset. Just one note regarding the purchase price. So Eastern's consultant appraiser valued the property at $292,000. There was quite a bit of back and forth with the seller. He ultimately decided to obtain his own appraisal, and that valued the property at $385,000. So ultimately, the parties agreed to kind of split the difference. So that's where the $338,500 comes in. And the recommendation today is to approve and authorize acquiring the property in the amount of $338,500. Execution of the purchase and sale agreement, as well as all necessary actions to implement and administer the purchase and sale agreement. And finally, approve an appropriation in the amount of $338,500. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Any questions? Director Slauson.
Yes, I think it's a good idea that we purchase the property. It seems cost-effective. In the staging area, accommodation, but I was wondering, that's sort of a homeless corridor through there. How do you propose to seal it off or fence it? Or
we will likely have to fence the property, probably not at the moment, further down the road after construction begins.
In addition, Dr. Slauson, we will fence, but we will also do regular site visits, make sure that we don't have any intrusion into the property or any type of vandalism or waste being deposited. So we'll definitely put it on our regular patrol for our security services.
I do know that the commercial building just to the south, that's been burned down a couple times from homeless starting fires inside, usually during the winter. Okay.
Very good. With that, would you like to make a motion? Sorry, did you have a question, Director Crone?
No.
Okay.
He's going to go. I'll second.
Make a motion by Director Slauson, second by Director Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. Thank you, Corey, for that. We will now go on to item 5 on our agenda today, which is our informational items and presentations. And I know we have a very special guest here today, and from the Southern Nevada Water Authority. And Mr. Mawad, if you'd like to introduce him, we look very forward to his presentation.
Thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. You are correct. We're very pleased to have with us today Mr. John Entspinger, who is the general manager of both the Las Vegas Valley Water District, which serves more than 410,000 customer accounts, as well as the general manager of Southern Nevada Water Authority, which is responsible for providing water to local agencies and collectively serve more than 2.3 million residents, as well as 40 million visitors, annual visitors. Prior to taking the helm at these two agencies in 2014, John was instrumental in the development of several groundbreaking water agreements. During his tenure, he has collaborated with other agencies on innovative infrastructure projects and recently led the implementation of non-functional turf removal legislation. He's been appointed by Governor Sandoval to serve as Nevada's lead negotiator on Colorado River matters and has played an active role in recent negotiations. SNWA and Eastern have a long history of collaboration and idea sharing, and we are very pleased today to have John join us to share some areas where SNWA is demonstrating leadership in water supply and water use efficiency.
Welcome. Welcome to Eastern Municipal Water District, and it is, again, an honor to have you, so thank you for coming. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Great to be with you guys today. I'm just going to go ahead and, you know, go through my presentation. I always appreciate a little more of a dialogue than just talking right at people. So if you have questions as I go, happy to stop and answer any questions, or, you know, wait until the end. Okay, so I'm going to spend the first, you know, part of the conversation, you know, really, you know, defining what we see as the major problem, and that is, we're as 7 states and 2 countries, we're using about 15 million acre feet of water, and the average of the last 12 years is 10 years is 12.3 million acre feet of water, and we got, you know, all the best climate scientists in the world telling us we'll be lucky if we get 11. On average by mid-century. So that leads to a very real possibility that Lake Mead could get to Deadpool. The 24-month study that I'll talk about here in a few slides shows getting into the 900s above sea level as early as 2024. Lake Mead, or Hoover Dam more accurately, stops generating electricity at 950, and it's physically impossible to move water through the dam at elevation 895. Our maximum, Nevada's maximum annual shortage right now is 30,000 acre feet if you combine 07 guidelines plus DCP. Our 50-year resource plan, we bake in a 40,000 acre foot reduction every year, but we know it's probably going to be lower than that. I'm sure you're all aware, Commissioner of Reclamation, Camille Tooten, walked into the U.S. Senate in January and said that we need permanent reductions across the basin of between 2 to 4 million acre feet, and we promptly did absolutely nothing about that over the 60 days that they had given us to come up with a plan. Nevada has one major disadvantage, and that's that our forefathers had the foresight to negotiate a robust 1.8% of the legal entitlements to the Colorado River, but we're making do, you know, with what we've got. So our response to the commissioner's call to action was to lay out what we think are extremely difficult but realistic actions, 12 different actions that we think can be implemented to bring this river into equilibrium for the 40 million Americans and 5 million acres of irrigated agriculture that rely upon the river system. That being said, we do think every user in every sector across the basin needs to contribute, that this is a problem of such magnitude that it simply cannot be borne by one basin, one state, or one sector that relies upon the river system. So I said I'd talk a little bit about the 24-month study. So this is the most recent version of the 24-month study. And our opinion is this paints a little bit too rosy of a picture. This is anticipating a 7 million acre foot release from Lake Powell to Lake Mead, and the red line, which in this slide shows as a worst case scenario, is the 10th percent hydrology. But that's, again, relying upon the entire period of record, so 1906 to 2021, which we think is wetter than what we're likely to get. If the Bureau of Reclamation has to protect Powerhead at Glen Canyon Dam this year, there's a very significant chance we'll have a release of less than 7 million acre feet from Powell to Mead in water year 2022, 2023. So we have to plan for the fact that this could be lower. I mean, this shows us getting down into the 900s, but again, that's the 10th percentile. There's, you know, 9% less than that, even with average hydrology, and with worse hydrology and a third straight La Nina staring us dead in the face, there's a chance we could be well into the 970s, 980s in calendar year 2024. So for Nevada, what does that mean? Our current DCP contributions plus 07 shortage contributions are 25,000 acre feet, so that takes our legal entitlement down to 275,000 acre feet. We're on track this year to use 228,000, so we've got close to 50,000 buffer, plus we have rights on our tributaries of the Virgin and Muddy River of about 30,000 acre feet. So we're actually, with the smallest allocation on the river, we're going to be leaving about 77,000 acre feet of water in Lake Mead this year. So turning from the big river picture to what we're doing locally, it's all of the above approach for us. I don't think I actually have a slide on water banking, so I'll just mention it now, particularly given our partnership with Metropolitan. Between our deal with Metropolitan, our banking agreements with Arizona, what we've done in Lake Mead, and what we've recharged in our own aquifer in Las Vegas, we have about 2.2 million acre feet of water now in reserve. So, you know, we're using 228 this year, so not quite 10 years, but over 9 years of our current demands that we've banked around the region. So I talked about our major disadvantage in only having 1.8% of the river, but we have at least three major advantages. And the first two come out of the fact that we're upstream of Hoover Dam. And the first thing that that allows us to do is recycle nearly 100% of all the water that's used indoors. The way I try to illustrate this to people is you could leave every shower head, every faucet in every hotel room on the Las Vegas Strip running 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. It doesn't deplete any more water out of Lake Mead. It's a closed loop. The only way we deplete water is outdoor irrigation, septic systems, which there are more of than I would like in the Las Vegas Valley, and evaporative cooling. So if we can control those and develop in a different way, we can come pretty close to new development having a zero water footprint. Our second major advantage of being upstream of the dam is we have engineering solutions that nobody else has. So we've now spent and completed $1.5 billion in new infrastructure using all local funding. We didn't get a dime of state or federal money to build both the third intake, which is a 3-mile, 20-foot diameter tunnel, literally underneath Lake Mead with the intake riser in the Colorado River channel where the river was before the construction of Hoover Dam, paired with a low lake level pumping station, which gives us the ability to pump water 20 feet below Deadpool. And our last major advantage is at the local level, we're politically pretty homogenous, which is kind of a crazy thing to say in 2022 in any context, but we don't have agriculture. We have one Native American tribe in Nevada with Colorado River rights. The Fort Mojaves and their rights were fully quantified in the decree in Arizona v. California. So all of our use is municipal industrial, which, you know, compared to Arizona having 22 tribes with claims to the Colorado River, makes our politics more simple than most of our partners on the river. It also allows us to do things uniformly. So I'm going to start talking about our conservation efforts, but critically, everything we've done in conservation for the last 20 years has been uniformly adopted across jurisdictional lines in every one of the municipalities and county levels. So there's no, I guess, opinion shopping when it comes to Henderson can have this kind of, you know, outdoor water usage in North Las Vegas can only have this kind. It's all uniform. So we've been getting ready for this for at least the last two decades. I think our real wake-up call was 2002, which is still the driest year in the recorded history of the Colorado River. That led to us adopting very aggressive, at least at the time, conservation measures that were all put in place by 2004. And it's worked. We've added over the last 20 years about 780,000 people to our service territory, but simultaneously we've driven down our per capita usage by 48%, and our net depletions off of the Colorado River have been reduced by 26%, despite almost 50% growth in our population. So it's not enough. With the situation we're facing on the river, our board adopted a new goal in December that we need to reduce our water usage from 110 gallons per capita per day, where it sits today, down to 86 GPCD by 2035. And the reasoning's simple. You know, nobody questions, you know, why San Francisco has different earthquake standards and why South Florida has different hurricane standards. Water scarcity, at least for Southern Nevada, is our reality, and all of our building codes need to better reflect that. So Joe mentioned the passage of Assembly Bill 356. That requires the removal of all non-functional turf by December 31st, 2035, should be more precise. It doesn't require the removal. You don't actually have to convert it. You simply can't use Colorado River water to irrigate it after December 31st, 2026. We've already removed about 5 million square feet of turf in the Las Vegas Valley just in calendar year 2022. Overall, over the last 20 years, we've taken out enough turf that you could lay an 18-inch wide piece of sod around the globe at the equator with the amount of turf we've taken out in Southern Nevada. This is also something that appears to be spreading. We signed a memorandum of agreement with Metropolitan, with Denver Water, with Pueblo, with Aurora in August. One of the commitments in that MOU is to remove 30% of non-functional turf. Obviously, we're already committed to getting out 100. And it looks very much like a number of cities, 20 to 25 more urban areas, will probably be joining on to that MOU you know, by the end of November. So Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Provo, Salt Lake City are all, you know, joining in. We've also now, you know, you got to take out the turf, but you also have to stop the bleeding. So we've prohibited the installation of any new turf, except in schools, parks, and cemeteries. So if you build a new home in Southern Nevada in 2022, you're not allowed to have any grass. golf course water budgets. We are already, one of the things we put in place by 04 was the first golf course water budget to get them down to 6.3 acre feet per irrigated acre. About 75% of the courses were already at 4, so we took the step of lowering that golf course budget for all the courses to 4 acre feet per irrigated acre. Pool sizes. Of all the things we've done, this is the one that would probably will save the least amount of water and the one that generated far and away the most controversy. But we had really seen an emergence of 3,000 to 5,000 square feet of poolscaping in some of the new luxury homes in Southern Nevada. So at poolscaping, it's not even functional swimming pools. It's, 12-inch deep. You know, apparently the rich people really like to, drink their coffee and watch Colorado River water evaporate. So we took the step of limiting the new pool sizes to no more than 600 square feet. Septics, we have about 19,000 septic systems in Southern Nevada. So step number one, stop the bleeding. You're now not allowed to hook into the potable water system unless you also hook into the sanitary sewer so that we can get those return flow credits. It's going to take us, we have $5 million in our budget this year to begin the conversion process. It'll take 10 or 15 years and probably several hundred million dollars to convert all the septics in Southern Nevada, but that's another step we're going to take. And then evaporative cooling. After lawns and swimming pools, the third largest consumptive use of water in Southern Nevada is evaporative cooling. So we're placing a moratorium on that. Our board will vote on that November 15th. So we expect, we have to give the development community some time to adapt. But by the January 1st, 2025, I believe only mechanical cooling will be allowed in new builds in Southern Nevada. So you add all that up, this is directly from our resource plan, and I haven't covered everything, but we've taken the step of quantifying every single conservation measure in our plan as a GPCD reduction. You'll see, the blue, I told you we're at 110. The reason that the dark blue is at 123 is because before we start reducing, first we bake in climate change. We expect our GPCD to go up by 9 gallons per person per day by 2035 just because of warmer local temperatures. And we've already seen that. Last year, you're supposed to go to 1 day a week watering November 1. And people did. But then it was so warm, it was like 85 degrees on November 15th. We saw 3 days a week. It just popped back up. So we're actually seeing it manifest itself. So warmer local temperatures and system age, we expect to drive our use up. So we inflate our 110 to 123 and then drive it down to 86 from there. And that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you very much. I'm sure our board members have questions for you, and it's probably Director Record be the place to start. Well,
so first of all, thank you for coming, John. I really appreciate it. And Southern Nevada has been such a leader over the years and really setting the bar high on what you can do and what you can accomplish. And certainly our goal here is to get to that point where we're not having any non-functional turf. We've already made some progress. I think we're way ahead of a lot of, especially member agencies, as far as not allowing new turf in the front of residential homes. And I've been a little frustrated that because I've been working on this, I've been on this board 22 years and met almost 20, and it's been just something that really irritates me because it seems so simple, and yet we just keep on doing it, and we just keep sending water running down the street. So we have to take advantage, we do, of this opportunity to really get rid of this stuff. And so and I push staff all the time, and I think we're doing a good job, but it just – for me, it just doesn't seem fast enough. And a lot of it, too, is I get tired of some of these big ag agencies saying, well, you guys with your swimming pools and your golf courses. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to do the best that we can do and show that we're using the water wisely and we're not doing things that are inappropriate. So I guess my question to you is, what are the biggest pushbacks from the public about getting rid of this? Is it different in Nevada because you guys have been out there for so long and you're the first ones to offer money to take out grass in residential places? Is it just property rights, don't tell me what to do, or it's just going to make it hotter here? How do you deal with that?
Well, I think sometimes the perception from outside Nevada is that some of the stuff we've done has been relatively easy and relatively straightforward. I would tell you every single one of those things I went over and a dozen more that I didn't talk about have taken a lot of political courage from our elected officials, and they've taken, you know, a lot of work, you know, at the staff level to get community buy-in. At the top box, like, we do very regular customer surveys, and we have 75-80% support for all of our conservation measures. They're very popular with the general public. But every one of those measures has 10 or 15% of our constituency that absolutely hates them. You know, to get that 600-square-foot pool size adopted, I had 25 pool builders lined up at my board meeting, every one of whom took their 3 minutes of public comment to just excoriate us for tanking the economy, that we're going to single-handedly prevent, you know, affluent people from relocating to Southern Nevada if we don't let them build, you know, these 3,000 and 5,000 square foot pools. The non-functional turf, you know, we have people, you know, coming out of the woodwork complaining that, you know, their dogs aren't going to be able to, you know, do their business on xeriscaping, and if we make them take out, you know, the grass between the sidewalk and the street. So I'm meandering, and I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but I think it's a day at a time, right? It's the old cliche about a journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. You just got to start doing it, and then do more, each year and build upon it. I became general manager in 2014. If you told me some of the things we're doing now, that we'd be doing that 8 years ago, I never would have envisioned it. But we've had to adapt.
Right.
With 1.8% of the river, our choice was very simple. You drive down your use, you figure out a way to grow without increasing your water footprint, or you stop issuing building permits.
Right.
That's the finite universe of the possible. And given where the river is now, I think that's basically where the rest of the river is heading. If you rely upon Colorado River water, you better be planning on having less of it.
Right. So your legislation, is that only for the Southern Nevada service area, or is for that the entire state?
Yeah, our legislature really likes to enact laws that only apply in counties of more than 1 million, which makes it only applicable in Clark County, where Las Vegas is, and it's not applicable to the rest of the state.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about state legislation also, and you have to wonder if it would be a big enough lift anyway if we just concentrated on the Met service area, because there are places where they're just going to go, we're not going to do it. And I don't know what happens down the road, but and maybe that's too big, but, you know, we're committed here, and we're working very hard on it. Another issue that continually comes up, and it's interesting to see how much of your water that's recycled, I mean, that's a lot of water. And it seems like we're always having people say, well, so I'm going to take the gray water out of the system, and I'm going to use it for my lawn or whatever. And we're reaching a point where our collection system may not work if we take the liquid out. We have treatment plants that are built on a certain, constituency of the sewage, and we use all our recycled water. So, just legislation just recently passed, continuing to ratchet down indoor water use. And so, we have to fight that battle. Do you see that in your area, or is that not viable?
Well, because we... we're on the shore of Lake Mead, and we get return flow credits. We've actually prohibited gray water systems. Like, people aren't allowed to install gray water systems in Southern Nevada. And we have incentives for people to use less indoors, even though it doesn't, increase our overall water supply, just because it obviously, our city's uphill from our water supply. So it costs money to pump the water uphill, it costs money to treat it. But we don't see a big decrease. We haven't seen any, challenges with moving the effluent downhill.
Well, that's good. I think that's appropriate to have the, a prohibition on taking gray water out of the system. And for a lot of other reasons, too, but that's a real concern of ours.
Director Corona?
Yeah, I had a question on the recycled water. So does your recycled water simply go into the Colorado River, or are you utilizing it also for groundwater recharge?
Yeah, we have done groundwater recharge in the past, but we never used our wastewater for it. We pump water out of Lake Mead and injected it into the river in Southern Nevada. We haven't done that in 3-4 years. We've been choosing to leave the water in the lake to help bolster the elevations instead of taking it off stream. So the way our wastewater collection system works, again, if it hits a drain anywhere in the Las Vegas Valley, it goes to one of four. We don't do wastewater, but City of Henderson, City of Las Vegas, Clark County, North Las Vegas, they all have wastewater or sewer agencies. So they all treat it. It gets funneled down the Las Vegas Wash. So it's actually green infrastructure that we've built, 23 weirs to slow the water down and establish a riparian corridor. So the water goes through the Las Vegas Wash, is metered, goes into the lake, and that's why we're allowed to take out, the exact same amount of water we put back in.
Okay, and so also I read about some complaint about Lake Las Vegas, and is that recycled water that's going over there, or is that Colorado River water?
Yeah, that's Colorado River water. I wish, at the DNA level that didn't exist, but, it was permitted, when I was in college. It historically has been there. The only way to get Nevada's Colorado River water out of Lake Mead, other than our facilities, historically it's called Basic Waters Cantilever. It was built in 1943 to support the munitions industry during World War II. That cantilever started sucking air at 1050, right? So it's out of the water. So that's how they had filled Lake Las Vegas before. So now there's an interconnection through the city of Henderson to fill that lake. And while I hate that lake, and they know I hate that lake, non-functional turf-wise, the community of Lake Las Vegas has about 300,000 square feet of turf they're going to have to take out under AB 356. So that gives me some solace.
That's all. Thank you.
Director Armstrong.
Yeah. Well, first, thank you for, making the time to come here. It was very informative and very interesting as well. And appreciate the innovative initiatives and programs that you're putting forward, because I think everybody benefits from everybody's efforts in moving the bar further down. So thank you. And I have a question then. So you mentioned the golf courses and the golf course budgets, but are the golf courses then, are they on recycled water or are they not on recycled water?
So historically they had been. There were two different wastewater treatment facilities built, one by Clark County, one by the city of Las Vegas. And so from, say, 2002 to 2018, there was, in fact, purple pipes and, conveying the wastewater to large turf applications, not just the golf courses, but some of the parks and schools. But they weren't... They weren't sufficient, right? They weren't self-sustaining. The capital cost of maintaining those facilities was so high that both the city and county wound up mothballing those facilities. So now, in order to maintain it, we're actually dumping potable water through the purple pipes to water those large turf applications. And again, These are the decisions of those who came before us, right? I don't know why those were really ever built, because it wasn't extending our resource, right? I mean, there's a lot of communities, most communities, that can get substantial returns on their investment from doing those types of recycling, right? My board's already appropriated $750 million for us to, you know, help fund Metropolitan's, you know, regional recycling project, because it, you know, makes sense when you're dumping your effluent into the Pacific. But when you sit on a major fresh body of water like we do in Lake Mead, really those things never should have been built, because recycling that water doesn't extend our resource by 1 gallon.
Thanks. Well, I just want to thank you again for being here today. So I'm going to leave you with a little anecdotal issue that we try very hard here all the time to convince people and tell them we're in a drought and we got to conserve water. But this summer I've had more people come up to me and tell me that, you know, we really are in a drought, because I saw in the news they're finding all these bodies in Lake Mead that have been dumped there. And so it's a weird thing, but anecdotally, I think, thanks to you, the message in Southern California is getting across that the Colorado River has some stressors on it, and we need to do a better job of conserving water, which I think this district, through our recycled water program, really have done. But anyway, I found that just anecdotally over the summer the most interesting thing of how people find the news, gather the news, and then come to a conclusion. And so in an offhanded way, thank you for that.
Well, we didn't kill any of those people, so I don't know if we deserve credit or not. But I would tell you, I don't know if this has made the news in Southern California or not, but entrepreneurs, you know, being who they are, we actually have stores in Las Vegas selling Lake Mead corpse water. So
all right.
That's life in my service territory right now.
Are you able to stick around and have lunch with us?
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Thank you again. All right, we will go to item B, which is our financial, operating, and capital highlights for the fourth quarter. I'm sorry. Mr. Adams, the floor is yours, sir.
Yes, good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Today, I have the pleasure of providing you the fourth quarter financial highlights and the update on the capital improvement plan. I'm going to tag team this with Ms. Alexander, who will cover the CIP, and I'll be brief on the finances. I think it's always nice to provide you guys an update when, this, as you will see, that EMWD had strong financial performance for the fourth quarter, which really trended very consistently throughout the whole year. So we try to pull up the next slide. So the presentation topics are very similar to past presentations. I'm going to spend a few minutes on the consolidated statement and really highlight a few things that we presented or actually created a few extra slides for. Certainly with the inflation and impacts on interest rates, I have a couple slides we added to this presentation, so I'll take a few minutes there and then just really cover the normal statements, the operating for water, wastewater, recycled water, and then talk also about connections and certainly the significant connection growth that we saw this past year, which was very consistent for the first three quarters. So consolidated, I apologize for this always being a little hard to read, but, you know, focusing on the first box, I think if you look above, operating revenue was strong across the board, both water and recycled water services, close to 10%, and then even with wastewater, that 3% or 2.6% increase really related to just connection growth. But in looking at non-operating revenue, strong in every category. Property tax overall was 5.7% higher than the budget. We did adjust this year's budget based on that growth, which you approved that budget adjustment back in June. Connection fees, you will see, very consistent from last year, almost 70% above our budget, which is really based on the long-term average of our connections. And then two areas which I'll discuss also, interest income, with the increases in the Fed rate and our return on our investments, certainly interest income has increased, and that's also baked into the 2023 budget. And then other income, really driven by late fees. As you recall, during the pandemic, suspension of late fees were applied, and so we did not collect it. But once you know, we reinstated those back in September. Those late fees were reapplied, and for this fiscal year, almost $5 million in late fees. Strolling down, just talk about debt service. Debt service was almost 18% under budget. That really has to do with two things. One, prior refinancings, but more importantly, the lower rates for our variable rate debt. So those really drove those expenses down there. And then the other one is other commitments. So overall, $15 million towards the pension trust fund. $4 million of that $19 million was actually paid to PERS to buy down some of our costs going out further. Overall, again, very strong financial performance. We actually had reserves actually increase based on, you know, the growth in connection fees, expenses being under budget. So we did not actually use reserves in supporting our capital on OFA for this year, actually added to reserves. So I mentioned a couple slides. This one just to show you where interest rates have gone over the past year. The first one is just to show you where they ended for the fiscal year. And we're really, this update is really through June 30th of 2022. So, you know, certainly there have been adjustments on interest rates by the Fed. But in that first column, you can see the graph at the bottom. We actually did a refunding on our GO bonds in December, really from a timing side, very fortunate to issue those bonds in December before rates started to increase in January. But you can see rates have significantly increased over the first 6 months of this calendar year, just to show you where the 30-year the AAA MMD is, and then SIFMA rates, our variable rate debt, has increased as well. But on the other side, certainly with rates have increased, since July, you can see that increase over the last 3 months has continued to increase, especially on the variable rate debt that's in the green bar. So the board is more than aware. We have done very active management on our debt portfolio. And so if you go back 10 years, we had significant exposure on the variable rate side, almost 36%. Only about 48 was actually fixed out that time. With the low interest rates over the past decade, we have taken advantage of that and really fixed it out. You can see the change in our portfolio from that aspect. Almost 85% is now fixed rate. We do have about 15-16% that's variable rate. That's about $150 million. That's based on SIFMA and variable rate as far as adjusting either daily or monthly. This brings up, as we see increases in interest rates, we're certainly seeing increase in our costs for those. But we also have significant cash on hand, right? We do have a significant investment portfolio, almost over $600 million. So in the left, you can see how variable rates have been increasing, but you can also see the right how our investment rate has also been returning. So it's just a natural hedge. As we see increases in our variable rate debt, we're also seeing increases in our interest income. So just quickly on operating, just water service. Overall, our sales a little over 10%. Revenue was almost 10% above budget. Operating costs of 3.4, but that's really driven by water purchases with MWD based on the increased sales. Overall, agricultural water sales, specifically to Lake Kemet, were higher than budgeted. So overall, water revenue was higher, certain expenses were, but still overall very strong performance on the water fund. And you can see here just those numbers, 9.8% overall above budget on the revenues, which was 5.7 above last year. And then operating expenses only 3.4, certainly driven by the purchase water of 7.9% increase over budget. Moving on to wastewater, certainly the increase in treatment flows for the quarter, 49 versus 48. Revenues were $3 million above, but 2.6 above budget, really driven by growth, the additional connections that have occurred over last year. On the cost side, really, I think the major driver is energy, was one of the larger cost increases that we've seen that was above budget, and certainly that's based on rate increases. Just quickly, you see the 2.6% above budget on revenues and just 0.5% under budget on the operating side, and really energy was 27. But overall, managed very well on the operations and the maintenance costs. Cycled water, I believe this is a high for EMWD, over 39,000 acre feet sold on the recycled water, 100% reuse above that actually, but you can see revenues were almost 10% above budget based on that additional acre feet sales. One of the drivers as far as cost was energy, very similar to the wastewater fund. You just see that here, 9.8% overall, 2.4% over budget on expenses, but really driven by energy, which was 45% over budget. G&A, under budget, but over 5.1 higher than last year. That 5.1 was really due to that $4 million payment to PERS for pension costs. But overall, under budget, very similar to prior year. With connection growth, which I did cover briefly, you can see reserves have increased for the quarter ending June 30th, $683 million in reserves. We did have some significant payments in the first quarter of this year, debt service, funding for the pension trust, and so that reserve number will go down when you see it the next quarter. But overall, the blue box in the right bottom, the connection fees, where you see a lot of that increase in reserves related to connection fees. We put this slide together just to show you both sewer at the top and water at the bottom, but to the left, sewer EDU connections and revenue 6.8% higher than prior year and 65% higher than what the budget is. Again, our budget is based on a long-term average, so certainly we don't adjust it. I'm trying to anticipate development growth as much as just trying to be consistent year over year. On the water side, it was just 1.3% under prior year, but still 50% over budget. So you can just see the numbers throughout the district in the different service areas has been almost, you know, significantly higher than initially projected. Quickly, other fixed assets, this is really the things that are non-capital improvement project related, vehicles, other maintenance. You can see there vehicles only 24% spent, but that is really doesn't say what's really occurred. All vehicles for last year and this year have already been ordered. This really just reflects the delays in the supply chain and us getting vehicles in a timely fashion. So certainly all vehicles for this year, I believe, I think it's close to 90% have already been ordered. There's just delays in getting that. So from an expense side, we show them as we actually pay invoices and don't pay them until we actually get them. So only 24%, which is really a reflection of that supply chain delay. And same thing with O&M. A lot of projects are at some point of progress, but because of delays in supplies and timing and stuff, underspent there about 51%. Those costs will just roll over until 2023 and 2024 in some cases. With that, I've tried to been as concise as possible. I'll turn over to Linnea to provide the update on the capital improvement program.
All right. Thanks, John. And I will also try to be quick. Oops. I think I know how to do this by now. Overall, this slide just provides a summary of our financial performance over the capital improvement program. And I'm very pleased to report a 94% overall execution of our CIP, very strong performance for our CIP implementation. Over the five-year outlook for our capital improvement program, we had a total budget of $534 million. With estimated external funding of $79 million. Our water system investments make up the majority of our CIP with an average of $61 million per year in investments on the water system over the next 5 years. Really, on this slide, I want to point out we have a lot of projects that are active, 181 active projects. Again, 66% of those on the water system, and the bulk of that work being in the construction phase. This just shows the performance over the four quarters of the fiscal year, again highlighting the fourth quarter with the performance at 94%, $99.8 million out of the budgeted $106 million. Of that, of $99.8 million of expenditures, the grant reimbursements totaled $20.5 million for an out-of-pocket total of $79.3 million. Our top five project expenditures are listed here on this slide and include the Murrieta Road pipeline improvement phase one at $11.2 million, and that is nearing completion. The Paris 2 desalter, which was completed earlier this year. Wells 201, 202, 203, and 205 equipping, which are part of our SARCUP program and the first phase of our enhanced recharge and recovery program. The Sky Canyon 36-inch expansion, which was completed earlier this year, as well as the Cactus II feeder phase one pipeline, which is approximately 75% complete. We had a variety of construction projects completed in this fiscal year listed here for total project costs of just under $52 million. The next two slides show the comparison of our engineers' estimates and the bid results for this fiscal year, and you can see a lot of volatility still in the market with estimates being significantly above in some cases, significantly below in some cases, but overall, when you look at it comprehensively, we were within 1% of all the projects that we had engineers' estimates for and bid. So not bad. There's a lot of lucky guessing in there. The next couple of slides show our strategic priorities and some project highlights associated with those strategic priorities. I'm not going to go through these each one. I'll just kind of go through these quickly. A handful of projects on our water recycling strategic priority, including pipeline, but also the advancement of our purified water replenishment project, which is currently in final design. And we recently received additional funding for that program, so this will continue to advance. We also have multiple projects going on in our salinity management above and beyond the completed Paris 2 desalter. We are advancing the Valley Boulevard Brackish water transmission project in partnership with the Army Corps, as well as the Brackish well siting study also with the Army Corps, which will allow us to further expand our desalination facilities. We are also advancing a series of projects for protection of public and environmental health, including our North Paris Groundwater Contamination Remediation Program. Again, recently, the State Board approved an additional $12 million of funding for that program. We are also continuing to advance the design and CEQA for the Quail Valley Sewer Subarea 4, as well as treatment at Well 56 for PFAS contamination. We have a variety of projects in our planning and also in investing in other areas, including solar. We also have a water supply strategic plan update that is ongoing. We are continuing to coordinate with Metropolitan and advance the CEQA for the Lake Skinner transmission system and EM11 connection for improved water reliability, as well as sewer flow monitoring and model calibration. And with that, I think it goes back over to John, unless you have any questions. There's also additional information in your books.
I just want to say we have a lot of good stuff going on. And
yes, we do.
Thank you, Linnea. With that, I won't read this, but I think just overall, very strong performance for 2022. We did close the books in late August and are finalizing our audit, which that update will come to the board in December, so I'm available for any questions from the board.
Any questions from Mr. Adams?
Good report.
No, I just want to say thank you again for the, as we watch interest rates tick up, that the report you gave on how that affects Eastern, which I think is marginal, but it's one of those things you think about as we do borrow a lot of money, and I'm watching interest rates go up. So I just want to say great job to our finance team for locking in some of those low rates. So.
Thank you very much, and appreciate the question and the discussion, yeah, certainly. So.
Very good. Thank you. We will go on now to the 2023 cost of service rate and study update. And are you going to do that?
I'm going to do a brief intro, and then I will turn over to Mark Panny.
Okay, so, very good. Okay.
So it's a pleasure to provide this briefing to the board. As you know, back in June, we provided an update to the board on the start of the cost of service study. And so since June through now, provide a lot of data to Corello Engineering. I've done a lot of analysis, and really this is just one of multiple workshops that will be brought to the board over the next 6 months, the next one being in December. Today, I'm gonna do the intro, but want to cover just a few points before I turn over to Mark Panny with Corello. So, again, really to provide you an interim progress report. We do have a few items that we want to give the board an update on, and really importantly, get your feedback and thoughts as we go through our process of developing the methodology to allocate cost. So not in any particular order. There was a request by the board to really understand our unit cost by source of supply. We actually have a nice slide that shows you that. We went into a lot more detail. It's not just an easy number. I have one number, but I want to show you how we got there, and Mark will cover that. We also want to discuss allocation of supplies and then residential household budgets. Certainly, legislation has recently been approved that changes that indoor use and some of the outdoor use potentially in the future. So Mark will cover that and the potential impacts. And then just briefly go into wastewater. Really, the two big things on there is looking at a postage stamp rate methodology, and then really our rate design related to the block factors. And so he'll cover that. Really looking forward to the board's feedback and input on this as Mark goes through it. Again, this is sort of setting up some discussion in December when we finalize the rate methodology and bring that back to the board for your approval. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Mark Panny with Corello to go through the presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. I don't have much to add to what John said, so other than just to reiterate, this is a briefing. We want to get your feedback on what we've been working on so far, some of the big items that we've seen so far, and then, as John said, in December, we will be back with our methodology recommendations for your feedback as well. So just starting off with water, the place we wanted to start here is talking about the residential budgets. So first, talking about indoor residential use and the budgets there. Right now, the Eastern and the state standard conservation target for indoor residential usage is 55 gallons per person per day. That was already set to decrease to 52.5 and then 50 over the next decade. With the recently passed Hertzberg bill, that's going to decrease even further to 47 and 42. So we just wanted to highlight this because it is instrumental to the rate structure. As you know, of course, with the budget-based rates, the indoor budget is a big piece of residential household budgets. On the other side of that coin of the budgets is the outdoor, of course. And the main thing that we want to touch on here is the ongoing imagery project that the district is undertaking. There are also changes to the outdoor conservation targets as well, both from the state and something that Eastern is exploring. But the big thing we want to touch on here is with that potential higher resolution imagery, which could change how much irrigated area each customer receives. I wanted to start off with these two items because they're pretty instrumental to some of the source of supply cost allocation that I'll talk about in a moment. Aside from just that, though, the changes on these two items, the indoor and the outdoor, will impact customer bills because it will change their budget. We'll have more quantitative impacts when we come back in December, but I just want to tee that up because it is pretty instrumental to both the source of supply allocation that we'll talk about today as well as the bill impacts that you'll get more detail about, but something to consider on that today as well. And on that note, just to kind of wrap up that topic, most of your customers do stay within their budget currently. So even with that ratcheting down that's potentially happening on indoor and outdoor, most currently do stay within their budget. And we looked at a couple years, and more than 80% of all the bills from 2018 through 2021 stayed within their budget. And that's a pretty meaningful number because that was a broad cross-section of usage periods. There were some drier years, some wetter years, some COVID years, some pre-COVID years. So there's a broad cross-section of different usage patterns in that sample. You see in that red box, those are the customers that would be impacted by these potential shifts. The customers right at their budget, in that 80, 90% of their budget range. So with the indoor use changes, a small percentage of customers are expected to be impacted. But when you add the outdoor on top of that, it could have a broader impact. And that's something we're gonna once we have draft rates and methodology, we'll have a better sense of the true impact of that on a bill. But we do expect that to take place in those customers who are right at the edge of their budget. And the last note on this slide is just that with that Hertzberg bill I mentioned, that is decreasing the indoor usage targets. But for a supplier like Eastern that has a robust recycled water program, there is a potential that those targets could be different. So that's something that staff is monitoring, and we'll be sure to implement in our rate design any of those changes that we get. Tying that to cost of service, the current cost of service is built on your cost to provide water at higher demand levels. We established this foundation of building on successively more expensive sources of supply as part of the last cost of service. And when you think about, a peaking profile, you use more water in the summer or more water in peak hours of the day, and the district must develop supplies to meet those peak periods. The lowest cost source you have, of course, is groundwater, and that we tied directly to Tier 1 in the last cost of service study. Above that, a blend of desalter water, water from the water filtration plants, and untreated MET purchases is when we started to get into Tier 2, and then when we get to Tiers 3 and 4 is when MET treated purchases come in. The concept here is that when we set up the cost of service last time and what's currently in place with the rates, each source of supply is tied to a tier, and so we have a strong cost of service foundation. But this is our starting point, and so I just want to present this as baseline, right? Looking at that from a slightly different perspective of tying each source to a specific tier, you can see local groundwater was fully funded by Tier 1 in that last study. Desalter production was fully allocated mostly to Tier 2 and some to Tier 3, similarly for the water filtration plants. And then when we get to MET purchased, treated purchases, Tier 1 is supplying Tiers 3 and 4. And then we also tied MET Tier 2 purchases to Tier 4. Of course, you're not purchasing water at Tier 2, but it is an avoided cost allocation. If users stay in that tier, the probability that the district would go and need those Tier 2 purchases increases. So, from a cost of service perspective, we wanted to include that differential as well. Aside from those sources of supply, pumping and distribution, everyone benefits from that, from the distribution system, from the pump stations. That's allocated evenly across all units of water, regardless of which source and which tier. Groundwater replenishment, the Tier 1 customers benefit from the groundwater supply. They also contribute to the groundwater replenishment. And then lastly, the inverse of that, conservation. So we allocated the majority of costs to Tiers 3 and 4. There are some in Tier 2 because everyone benefits from conservation and everyone has some potential to conserve more. But we put most of the costs in Tier 3 and 4 because that is where a lot of the concerted messaging, the really direct communication with customers needs to take place. Is in those customers who are in tiers 3 and 4. So John alluded to the unit cost by source, and there's a lot of information on this one, so let me walk through step by step. I really want to focus on the groundwater and the desalter costs here. We can touch on the water filtration plants and MET purchases, but want to focus on those sources as well as that blended production cost. And John indicated that there is a single number we could use. We could just look at the operating cost, right? And that would provide a single point in time for this year, how much does it cost to produce water from that source, right? But we wanted to look at this from a holistic life cycle perspective. We wanted to include the cost to replace and repair those assets associated with those sources. And because that often takes place over, you know, there can be many years where no investment takes place, and then there's a large investment in replacing or repairing assets. So it's difficult to capture in one single number the cost for capital for these items, especially because almost all of these, all of these were originally built by FPC revenues, you know, as part of expansion. But over time, as those assets are replaced, that's funded by rate revenue, because the current rate, the current customers are contributing rates to the replacement of those assets. So what we decided on was to use capital depreciation. You know, it's an annual snapshot of how much that asset depreciates. And so if you were to save that much money every year, over the course of a useful life of that asset, you could fully replace it. That's the number we chose. And so for each source of supply, you can see the operating costs there from the district's 2024 projected budget, the capital depreciation that we have, and then a total annual cost for that source in those first three columns. Then we took the projected production from each source. And in that red framed column, you can see the operating cost on a unit basis for each asset. As I said, groundwater is your least expensive source of supply from an operating perspective, as well as from, you know, aside, of course, from met treated purchases, from a depreciation perspective as well. Above that, we wanted to show the desalters, and we wanted to break out the desalters between Paris 2 and the Paris 1 and Menifee desalters. So on a depreciation perspective, the desalters are very comparable. You know, that's not surprising that the annual depreciation is very similar for those. But from an operating perspective, the Paris 2 desalter is less expensive, and that is largely due to that LRP credit that the district receives, which brings down the operating cost for Paris 2. So we want to highlight that, and I'll build on that in the next slide, why that, you know, matters for this study. But you just wanted to highlight that piece. And so, you know, you can also see at the bottom right there, the blended production cost is roughly $11.50 per acre foot when you look at all sources of supply across the whole district. But, you know, we wanted to break this out as much as possible while providing, you know, a good snapshot of unit cost. So I wanted to show that unit cost because it kind of has it has a big impact on how Tier 1 is developed. So just some background. Tier 1, when we developed it in 2017, we tied that directly to how much groundwater was available. And at the time, we had a projection for how much production there could be and then how much usage was budgeted in the indoor and outdoor. And that equated to about 20% of all residential budgets could be met by groundwater. Now, what we've seen, you know, 5 years later is that that number is actually lower. It's around 12%, just due to a combination of, you know, projected production being a little lower than we expected, as well as growth that has taken place. And so the amount of budgeted usage has grown beyond what that 20% originally could support. We've identified two potential solutions for this, really one, but two different ways of implementing it, and that is to blend desalters in with that groundwater. This would continue to provide the Tier 1 customers with a lower cost source of supply before they get to that blended Tier 2 met water. There are two ways of approaching that. One is to just use all desalter water blended with groundwater, and that would be able to meet 26% of indoor plus outdoor demand, or sorry, budgeted usage. And then the other option is to just use Paris 2 because that is the next least expensive source of supply. That's around 18% of available budget or budgeted supply. So a couple options that we want to present, you'll get your input on. We'll continue to model this and have impacts. You know, that would change that Tier 1 rate, but we're hoping that by increasing the amount that the Tier 1 could comprise of each budget, that hopefully will mitigate some of the bill impact. Just just returning to the conceptual diagram and what that might look like going forward, of course, groundwater would still be that lowest cost in Tier 1, and we would expect that Paris 2 at least would be in Tier 1. When it comes to Paris 1 and Menifee, you know, could be Tier 1, could be Tier 2. We're still working on that, and we'll be sure to present the impacts to you to make a decision on that. And then from there, Tier 2 would essentially still be met untreated and water filtration plants. And then when we get to Tiers 3 and 4 is when we get to the met treated purchases. And similar figure again, just showing that additional breakout that Paris 2 would be in Tier 1, and Paris 1 and Menifee would be, you know, to be determined at this point. So before I switch gears to wastewater, were there any questions on the water side?
Well, I mean, there's so much information here, and it's really valuable information. And we're really pressed for time today, and I almost feel like maybe we should stop the discussion now and come back and spend more time on it, because at least that's...
No, I was about to say the same thing.
Because that information on our water supply and what the different aspects of it cost, it's really valuable information and really enlightening. So if we could, I'd prefer
I would concur if we could.
We can absolutely do that, President Paul, Director Record. This is an important conversation to have with the board, and we definitely want to get your feedback. So with your concurrence, we can definitely continue this conversation at the next board meeting, and that way we'll have more time, more ample time. But we do want to get your input. There's been a lot of work done here. This is still work in progress. As Mark mentioned, we don't necessarily have the sensitivity analysis done as far as potentially how this would impact an average customer's bills. That is yet to come. What we're trying to define here are the foundation, if you will, on the approach. And but yes, absolutely. We'll come back and we'll have that this conversation.
And again, apologize to you. We got a late start because another event today. We had our special guest, so there's a lot going on. I completely concur with Director Record. This is important stuff for us to get right, and so I'd rather kind of break that up so we can digest it. So
absolutely
appreciate your patience with that.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. It has a lot of meaningful impact, so you know we absolutely want you to really understand it and be comfortable with it and have a chance to provide feedback.
So we'll come back to the wastewater and recycled rates, correct?
We will, and possibly even since Director Salson had to step out, we can go back and do a real quick recap next time.
Let's go ahead and do that. So,
right,
we'll have a return engagement.
We will do
okay?
that. Okay.
Thank you very much. Great information, though. All right, we're going to go to item 6, which is to receive and file various reports. I'll make a motion to do so. Second. Director Armstrong would like to second that. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 4-0 with Director Slauson absent. That will bring us to our calendar review. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. I have four events for your consideration for today. They are Thursday, October 23rd, is the Southern California Water Coalition's annual meeting in Long Beach. On Saturday, November 12th, is the Boys and Girls Club annual gala in Menifee. On Thursday, December 8th, is the County of Riverside State of the County address. And then on Friday, December 16th, is the water education poster judging contest here in the boardroom at the district. So,
could you put me down for the poster judging?
Sure, most definitely. On page 2 is the board member's master calendar for the next 2 weeks. Please review this information and let me know if you have any changes or updates. At the top of page 3 is the upcoming events and conferences with participants. Tomorrow is the State of the City address in Menifee on October 20th, followed by the Wednesday, the 26th, is the debriefing and desalter tour with the State Senator Ochoa Bogue. And then Friday, November 4th, is the State of the City address for the City of Hemet. And Tuesday, November 29th, is the beginning of the Aqua Fall Conference at Indian Wells. So continuing on page 3 is the board and board committee meetings through December. Right now, all the meetings are currently scheduled on time, minus the Retirement Trust Committee did move to December 5th, which is a Monday. So, and then at the top of page 4 are the interagency meetings through January, and those are all on schedule. So, and then in observance of the holidays coming up, EMWD's offices will be closed on November 11th, November 24th and 25th, and December 26th. So, any questions regarding the report?
Very good. Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Yep, no
you
problem.
Do a wonderful job of keeping us all organized. We will go to director's attendance reports. We will start with Director Armstrong.
Hey, I attended the Marietta Temecula Group drought update meeting. That was a presentation by Eastern, Western, Rancho, and Elsinore Valley together. Did a really good job on high-level drought, state, regional, and but also the collaboration efforts that are taking place here regionally between the agencies. So I thought it was a really good update there. Special Board of Directors Legislative Strategies meeting. I just appreciate the effort there and the ability to dive into that, you know, a little with focus individually. And already talked about the Paris Ad Hoc Committee meeting. So those are my updates.
Very good. Appreciate that. Director Corona.
Okay. the monthly meeting with General Manager, as always, was great. The EMWD and Rancho California Water District ad hoc committee was also good. The especially energetic Darcy Burke on that one. The Myriad Temecula Group was already covered by Jeff. EMWD and Elsinore Valley Municipal Water. Oh, I mixed up the two between Elsinore and Rancho, but both those meetings were similar. I did not attend the Cahuilla Band meeting, and I'm sure that President Pauly will cover that. Discussion with Representative Mark Takano was really, really good. It's always very interesting meeting with a congressman and learning about not just the work he's doing for us here at Eastern and in Southern California, but global events also were just very, very interesting. Special Director's Legislative meeting, Jeff covered that. Rancho Board meeting, nothing exciting in particular. They did extend their COVID special meeting stuff, and the Los Alamos Hills town meeting was also very good. Very appreciative audience. Got a lot of applause for our staff and for working with the property owners, and I think you could see a little bit of the result from the public input this morning. And that's all I have.
All right, very good. Thank you so much. As noted, I did attend the Cahuilla Band of Indians Inquiring for Water Service meeting. I thought it was very interesting. There's a lot more to digest there. I appreciate Stephen's participation in that. I think, again, with anything, getting the annexation issues into Matt and Eastern are going to be some of the challenges on that, and everybody understanding what those responsibilities will be. As noted, we had a great meeting with Representative Takano, had a thoughtful discussion, got into, on the water side, tanks and tank capacity.
That's the wrong kind of tanks.
Well, I was going to mention that, but say tank and tank capacity. Legislative Strategies meeting, obviously, was a very good. I appreciate our legislative team and Jolene putting that together. I thought it was very helpful on where we're going. Los Alamos town meeting is covered. Great job by staff, John Adams. Nick did a fine job. I will say, though, the hero of the night, in my opinion, was Greg Kowalski. One of the areas we forgot, we had a robust discussion with the group about water meter size, and it dawned on me halfway through, and I think Joe too, these people have never had water meters. So I had a couple of them that didn't want to join the program because they didn't know what size water meter to get. And I will tell you that Greg was just did a fantastic job of talking to those people and really being helpful. So I was really pleased with that. Good outreach meeting with April on our PGA team and some of the educational opportunities she wants to do going forward. I, of course, am always supportive of that. Southern California Water Committee, I was not able to attend. I was here over the weekend for our purified project open house. And again, I kudos to staff on that. I was unable to have a meeting with the general manager because of a schedule conflict the other day. And then this morning, we attended Supervisor Washington's State of District 3, which really was well done. A lot of the program on video presentation was on all the projects that Eastrim was doing. Laura joined us with some other staff members this morning. That was well done, and got to interact with Juan Perez and a lot of people that are helping us out with what we have coming down with the ARPA funding from the county. So that was good. It's my report, Director Record.
Yeah, Joint Inland and Orange County Caucus go over the met agendas. I find it a helpful discussion. Standing committee and board meetings, we've covered a few of those already today. You do have a complete report from Jolene. EMWD meetings, the director's legislative strategies meeting was good. It's good to talk to our representatives face-to-face and talk about the future. Update with general manager is good, and state of the city address, I guess the nice thing about it was that the Eastern table was mostly filled with City of Hemet people, that's great. We had a good relationship for them. And the mayor of San Jacinto didn't talk too much about Eastern, which is probably a good thing too, but they seem to be optimistic about the future. So that's it.
Very good. With that, we'll move down to director's comments or future agenda items. Does anybody have comments or future agenda items?
So, Joe, I'll get with you. I want to just get more detail on where we're at in the process of the non-functional turf engagement with people, and maybe after exec committee tomorrow or something we could have.
Sure, absolutely, okay. Dr. Record. And we will have a more formal update on non-functional turf at the next planning committee, but I'd be happy to catch up with you tomorrow as well.
And I'm sorry, does anybody else have a closing? I just wanted to follow up. One thing I forgot was from yesterday's four-agency meeting, one of the things I requested is, as we've narrowed this down to three projects, at some point we get a board presentation to this board of what those three projects may look like and how we may move forward. So I think that would be helpful. With that, I'm going to ask Stephen, do we have a need for closed session?
We do, Mr. Chair, pursuant to Government Code Section 54957 and 54956.9, as identified on item 9.
Very good. So can we ask the board secretary if we could change over to closed session?
Yes.
We are back in open session. Mr. Legal Counsel, could you please report out of our closed session items?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The board met in closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 54957 to discuss security issues concerning public service and public facilities. A report was given to the board. No reportable action on that matter. The board also met pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9 to discuss one item of potential litigation. A report was given to the board and instruction was given to staff. No formal action was taken in that matter. That concludes my closed session report.
Very good. And with that, we will adjourn until November 2nd at 9 a.m.
Thank you.